Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
The Global Story is your new daily deep dive into one big news story. And it's coming soon, Monday to Friday, from the BBC World Service. Search for The Global Story wherever you get your BBC podcasts to find out more.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 23rd of November, these are our main stories. Exit polls from the Dutch parliamentary elections put the party led by the anti-immigrant populist Geert Wilders well ahead of its rivals. Relatives of the hostages held in Gaza wait to see who could be freed in the coming days. Rescue workers drilling to free more than 40 workers trapped under a collapsed tunnel in India say they're close to getting them out. Also in this podcast,
he said to me, there's been an accident and I don't know how to tell you this, but your husband's dead.
How do we make film sets safer? And why Britain's King Charles is engaged in K-pop diplomacy. In what could be a big political upset, exit polls in the Netherlands suggest that voters in Wednesday's parliamentary elections have lurched sharply to the right. According to those exit polls, the party of the anti-immigrant populist, Geert Wilders, has won the most seats, which in theory means he could head a coalition as prime minister. This was after a campaign in which he toned down his anti-Islam rhetoric. But it's not clear he'll be able to form a government, as we heard from Anna Holligan in The Hague.
We've had two sets of exit polls. Both of them suggest that Geert Wilders' Freedom Party is indeed the largest party. And what that means is not necessarily that he will be the next Prime Minister of the Netherlands, but that he will be given the first opportunity to try to form a coalition government. And we have had an indication from him already. He has made a victory speech and he appears to be reaching out to the other parties, signalling he's prepared to compromise, saying he wants to control the tsunami of asylum within the limits of the constitution. I'm just outside the VVD, Liberal Conservative Centre-Right party, although watching people inside and listening to their size, they're drowning their sorrows now, because actually Dylan Yasilgog, their leader, who took over from Mark Rutte, was widely tipped to be the first ever female prime minister of the Netherlands, and these exit polls suggest that is looking much less likely to be the case. And even if Geert Wilders fails to convince enough other parties to join him in a governing coalition, if the other parties refuse to do that, they will be accused of failing to listen to the voice of the people when such a significant portion of the population have voted for this man. And just in the context of Brussels, bear in mind, in his manifesto, he has offered the possibility of a Nexit, a Brexit referendum for the Netherlands. He wants to take the party out of the country, out of the EU. He says the majority of his supporters want to leave the EU. Having said that, when I spoke to him when he was casting his vote this morning, when I spoke to him after the final TV debate last night, he was trying to reassure people in this country and beyond that he was prepared to be a prime minister for the entire country if he is indeed given the opportunity. So what happens now? We should get the final results on Thursday, and from that point on, the complicated, more complicated than anyone had expected probably, process of trying to form a new governing coalition will begin.
Anna Holligan. For weeks, the families of the hostages in Gaza have endured an agonising wait to see if their loved ones will be freed. Now, for some, the nightmare may be ending under the terms of a deal where Hamas is due to soon start releasing 50 women and children in return for 150 Palestinian women and children being freed from Israeli prisons, a four-day pause in the fighting and an influx of aid, including fuel, into Gaza. Idit Oel's son, Elon, was taken hostage by Hamas on October the 7th. She explained why talking about her son was so important.
The most important thing for a mother for all mothers is that their son is known, and it's not just another number. So it's not like 236 people. We have to remember that each one has a life. Each one has a name. Each one has a family, you know, behind them. It's not just a number. For me, talking to you makes them be more real. There is a story behind it, you know? And that makes it very important that everybody in the world will know that.
The Hamas-run health authorities in Gaza say Israel's air and ground assault, which is still ongoing, has now killed more than 14,000 people, most of them women or children. The desperate plight of Gaza's children was highlighted at the UN Security Council by the children's agency UNICEF amid concerns that the four-day truce is too short to help many of them. Their spokesperson is Catherine Russell.
More than 5,300 Palestinian children have been reportedly killed in just 46 days, over 115 a day, every day, for weeks and weeks. Based on these figures, children account for 40% of the deaths in Gaza. This is unprecedented. In other words, today, the Gaza Strip is the most dangerous place in the world to be a child.
Even as the clock counts down to this expected hostage and prisoner exchange, dozens more Palestinians have been reported killed in the latest fighting. There's confusion over whether the Red Cross will be allowed to visit the hostages still left in Gaza after the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said they would, but they said they hadn't received any information about this. Our Jerusalem correspondent, Tom Bateman, told us more about the preparations.
What we're hearing in the Israeli media tonight is one key part of the choreography ahead of this expected deal to be implemented tomorrow is that in Qatar tonight, the head of Mossad is expected to receive a list of the hostages, the first batch of hostages to be released, which is said to happen at midday tomorrow local time. Now, this is important because that will be the first indication, obviously, to the Israelis about which hostages Hamas intends to hand over to the Red Cross to then be taken to the Rafah crossing and to be brought to the Israeli liaison point. And now, the Israeli media reports are that the families wouldn't be told about who's on those lists, and in fact, they wouldn't be told anything until the first batch of hostages have been handed to the Israelis. And we've just had Daniel Hagari, the chief spokesman for the Israeli military, talking, but suggesting that they don't have an absolute, or he wouldn't talk about a confirmed time for the start of the ceasefire. Now, our understanding earlier was that the time that was being talked about was 10 o'clock local time tomorrow morning, and you would then have the first batch of hostages released from noon. So, you know, 2 hours presumably to verify that a ceasefire is holding before the first hostages were released. And then Israel would release three times the number of Palestinian prisoners. So if 10 Israeli hostages were to be released, around 30 Palestinian prisoners would then be released by Israel. But the sense we got from Daniel Hagari, the military spokesman, is that, you know, things still feel quite tentative, a lack of clarity about, you know, all of the pieces falling into place. They're in unprecedented circumstances trying to do a hostage or prisoner exchange with this number of people during, you know, this war, this level of fighting. Nothing like that has ever been done between Israel and its adversaries before.
Tom Bateman in Jerusalem. And since we spoke to Tom, the office of the Israeli Prime Minister has put out a statement saying the release of the hostages will not be before Friday. Clearly, as Tom said, things are still very tentative. As we record this podcast, rescue workers drilling to free more than 40 men who've been trapped under a collapsed tunnel in India for days say they're close to a breakthrough. Engineers are driving a steel pipe through tons of earth, concrete and rubble to reach the men. Rescue efforts have been complicated by drilling machines breaking down, and work was suspended on Friday after a cracking sound raised fears of another collapse. Samira Hussein is at the scene.
I'm actually standing about 100 metres away from the mouth of the tunnel, and if you can hear that whirring behind me, What they have been doing is drilling a hole through the front of the tunnel, going through the rubble and debris to try and reach the men. Now, earlier rescue attempts had been hit by some machine difficulties, so two machines had already broken down. Now this third drilling machine that they have, rescue officials say they're actually making really good progress, that they've already gone through about 45 meters of debris, and that was a few hours ago, and they have about 57 meters of debris before they reach the trapped workers.
And are they planning to work through the night?
Absolutely. In fact, this new drilling machine, as soon as they got it up and running, they started drilling right away. So that was at 2 a.m. and they're still drilling. There's no sense that they're going to be stopping anytime soon.
And what about the men? What do we know about their condition? Because we did see those first pictures of them a couple of days ago.
Interestingly, I actually spoke with one gentleman who is here. His cousin is in the tunnel, and he has been here for the last week or so. And he said that he spoke to his cousin, and his cousin said, "Don't worry, we're doing okay." And officials have been maintaining the same thing in terms of the health of the men that are inside, that they're still doing well. And on that video, you heard them asking, "Is everyone okay?" and doing a roll call and assuring them that they will be rescued. That said, the have brought in quite a few ambulances. There are four ambulances that are inside the tunnel waiting for the rescue to help any men that may need it.
Because they've been trapped for 11 days. It's very cold at night there, and they've only just recently started getting hot food.
To give you a sense of just how cold it is, it's in the single digits. I am wearing two coats, a hat, and a scarf. And if I am so cold out here, I can only just imagine what it is like for the men that have been underground for so long. Yes, they are receiving cooked food now. They have access to water. And the space that they're in is about 2 kilometers wide, so they are able to walk around. But it's still quite cold, especially at night.
And some of the relatives are unhappy that it's taken this long to even get this close.
Absolutely. I think because there were so many failed attempts at the very beginning, many family members and friends that had gathered here were really quite frustrated that it was taking so long to get them and that there weren't other plans being made. But now there's a sense among some family members that they're being provided with somewhere to stay as they wait for their loved ones. They're being provided with food and they're being provided with a little bit more information than they had been before.
Samira Hussain in the Indian state of Uttarakhand. The United States says it's treating the reported plot to kill a Sikh separatist on US soil with the utmost seriousness, and it says it's raised the issue with the Indian government. A White House spokeswoman said Delhi had expressed surprise and concern at the reports and had begun an investigation. Gary O'Donoghue has more details.
Gurpatwant Singh Panon is a New York-based lawyer for Sikhs for Justice, a separatist group that calls for an independent Sikh homeland within India. He's declined to comment on the alleged plot, but a spokesman for the National Security Council, Adrian Watson, said the US had conveyed the expectation that anyone deemed responsible should be held accountable. There are also reports that at least one individual has been indicted in the case, but details have not been made public.
Gary O'Donoghue. Still to come?
Absolutely, he lived frugally. He wouldn't buy anything for himself unless he absolutely had to.
A small US town gets a surprise from a secret millionaire. Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. Britain has been engaged in K-pop diplomacy this week. On Tuesday night, King Charles hosted the South Korean president at a lavish state banquet at Buckingham Palace. The king admitted to a personal lack of what might be called Gangnam style, but the military banned for the changing of the guard put that right on Wednesday. And the king presented the four members of Blackpink, the South Korean girl group, with honorary MBEs, while President Yoon Suk-yeol looked on. I asked our royal correspondent, Sean Coughlin, why the king was handing out these honors to the pop group.
The answer given by them is because of their environmental campaigning. They worked with the COP climate summit And they've been ambassadors for the UN as well.
And climate change is an issue dear to King Charles' heart.
That's right. And they're seen perhaps as an avenue towards young people, as a reference to the millions of young people they can connect through their music. But I think underlying this is a sort of diplomatic courtship that's going on. And I think King Charles wants to try to turn this state visit into more than the usual set of banquets and ceremonial occasions. Try and make it a bit lighter, but also make sure that everyone knows that he is taking South Korea seriously. He respects their culture. He went to the biggest concentration of Koreans in Europe, in New Malden, a couple of weeks ago, and heard all about K-pop and Korean food. And yesterday's speech in the state banquet is all about the global reach of Korean culture through K-pop and their celebrity culture, which has now been embraced by people in Britain and around the world. I think this is a sort of dual-track approach, trying to, in some ways, have a nice, friendly, rather glittery, sparkling social occasion. But underneath it, it's quite hard-nosed politics. And this is about trade and it's about military cooperation. And there are sort of coded references to tensions in the region with China and their sort of difficult neighbourhoods. So I think it's a bit of both those things. State visits are an odd mix of pageantry and politics.
And now a bit of pop as well. So we had that state banquet in which we saw King Charles speaking a few words of Korean to the delight of his guests. And it was a very glittering occasion, as you say. But sadly, we didn't see the South Korean president singing as he has done on a previous visit to the US.
I think that really would have improved the occasion. American Pie was his karaoke song of choice when he met Joe Biden. This was more of a sort of straight-laced occasion. And even though, you know, King Charles threw in his own references to pop culture, the Korean president, Yoon, didn't reciprocate. Though he did talk about how much he loved Elton John and the Beatles and Queen. And when he referenced Queen, we assumed he meant the pop group and not any members of the royal family. And it was quite a jolly occasion, I have to say. Very, very, very big, very epic ballroom they use, 4,000 pieces of a dinner service and fancy cutlery, and everyone gets six glasses. But again, it was about sort of the business of sort of diplomatic schmoozing. But I think sometimes these can be quite dull occasions and quite dour. This was quite light, and it must have been a deliberate approach to keep it youthful, young, focusing on K-pop rather than just on money.
Sean Coughlin. Africa is the continent most affected by malaria. Nearly all malaria deaths occur there, most of them children under the age of five. Now a groundbreaking malaria vaccine, the first to be approved by the World Health Organization, is being delivered there. Cameroon has received more than 300,000 doses, with more deliveries expected over the coming weeks to other West African countries. It's already made a big difference to nations like Kenya and Ghana, which were involved in the malaria pilot program. Here's our Africa health correspondent, Dorcas Wangira.
Cameroon's health minister, Dr. Manaouda Malachi, says the delivery of the malaria vaccines is a historic moment. Aurelia Nguyen from Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance's chief program officer, told the BBC that there is more work to be done.
It's not just a question of getting the vaccine in country. Of course, that's an important part and a huge milestone. But we need to also make sure that we have the infrastructure in place, the cold chain, because the vaccines need to be kept at cold temperature, the training of healthcare workers. The last thing you want is just a vaccine to appear out of the blue and people not to understand what it's for, how it can be helpful.
The vaccine is administered in four doses for children from the age of 5 months to 2 years. In Kenya, Ghana and Malawi, more than 2 million children have received at least a single dose. Malaria is highly endemic in Cameroon, a deadly disease that is responsible for 70% of deaths among children. Fulcam Joel, a citizen, knows what it's like.
Dans une maladie qui est commune.
It's a usual disease that we grew up knowing. Whenever a child got malaria, we'll generally say they were affected by the disease because they were growing up. So yes, I have been affected by malaria, and it's also common among people around me. I'm not aware of the rollout of the vaccine, not at all.
The shots are expected in children's arms by next year. WHO says the vaccine could save one life for every 200 children vaccinated.
Dorcas Bangira reporting. Behind the glamour of film sets lies a workplace that can be dangerous. And now the movie industry is returning to sound stages and on-site locations following the recent writers and actors strikes in Hollywood. Industry figures are calling for health and safety to be made a priority to avoid any more lives being put at risk. A series of high-profile accidents has raised questions about the hazards involved for actors and crew members while making films and TV shows. Our entertainment reporter, Sophie Van Bruggen, has been looking into the issue here in the UK.
This is one of the last pictures of Daddy.
Andrew Milsom is looking through tributes to her cameraman husband with her daughter Alice.
Do you remember any of this?
No.
Alice was just 11 when she lost her father. Mark Milsom died when filming a stunt. The camera he was on should have been unmanned.
My only real memory of that day is, like, I heard my mum, like, scream and cry.
There was this very nice policeman on my doorstep with my mother hysterical. And he said to me, there's been an accident. And I don't know how to tell you this, but your husband's dead. It was just completely and utterly devastating.
I still text him, so yeah, when things happen, I text him.
An inquest concluded the accident was entirely preventable, and for Andra, it's left her with the conviction that there's a wider safety problem.
I'd like the health and safety officer to be on that set, hold these people accountable, hold their risk assessments accountable, and make sure that no family has to go through what we've been through. I think that until health and safety is no longer a box-ticking exercise, nothing's going to change.
Why do you think it isn't?
I think people are scared.
I've been speaking to dozens of people who work in the industry, from film crew and set designers to runners, who have either been injured or had near misses. They were too afraid to go on record for fear of being labelled troublemakers and not getting hired again, as they've seen happen to others. The health and safety executive told us that without a change in the law, it can only get involved after an accident is reported. And what's adding extra urgency to this is the rapid growth of the UK's film industry. When it comes to studio space, it's now bigger than Hollywood. So safety regulations, which were written in the 70s, are felt by campaigners to be simply out of date. Cinematographer Chris Ross is finally able to return to filming following the actor strike. He's previously worked on big-budget films like Yesterday and Cats, and he leads the organisation that represents the UK's camera operators.
The industry is scaling up in a way that it's never been before. If the status quo stays the same, there will be more injuries, there will be more deaths. Fundamentally, the change needs to be industry-wide. And if that requires a high-level change of law, then if that's what it takes, that's what it takes.
The family of cameraman Mark Milsom have set up a foundation to help improve safety standards. Samantha Weinstein runs it.
The law, which was made in 1974, so it's nearly 50 years old, is not really currently fit for purpose. It does require employers to look out for the safety of their staff, but there's no requirement for somebody to prove that they've been trained. There's no certification which is recognised globally in this area.
That report was by Sophie Van Bruggen. Geoffrey Holt was an unassuming man. He enjoyed a simple life, doing odd jobs here and there. His death at the age of 82 earlier this year was mourned quietly by some of the 4,000 residents of a small US town where he lived. So the people of Hinsdale in New Hampshire were shocked to learn that he'd left a considerable sum to the neighbourhood, nearly $4 million. My colleague James Reynolds spoke to Geoffrey's friend Edwin Smith.
He was a rather shy gentleman. He was quite knowledgeable about international things and national things, but he didn't really participate in anything local as far as social organizations or participating in government, except for making sure that he voted. And he did that without question.
We're told he lived frugally. Did you see that?
Absolutely, he lived frugally. He wouldn't buy anything for himself unless he absolutely had to. The one exception to that, he did like his beer. He didn't drink to excess. I never saw him when he was inebriated, but he did enjoy a beer or two. But he always bought the least expensive beer he could.
How surprised were you?
I was surprised several years before because he had told me that his investments had done very, very well. His investment account had over seven digits in it, seven figures. So that was probably 15 years ago. I hadn't kept up with it since then. He told me that the investments are doing well, but we never talked specifics. So I really wasn't too surprised. I didn't share that information with many people because I didn't want him to be bothered by somebody knowing anything.
Edwin, it's not just that he lived frugally. It's not just that he had a fortune of almost $4 million. It's that in his will, he left that to the town. How is the town going to spend that money?
That money is going to be sent to the New Hampshire Charitable Foundation. And they have several funds, many funds that are like this. And they take the income or from the trust that they hold, and they will dispense that to the various entities in Hinsdale that will benefit from it.
That was Edwin Smith speaking to James Reynolds. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. Now, as the next UN summit on climate change approaches, we're making a special edition of the Global News podcast looking at where the world has got to in its efforts to tackle the problem. So we want your questions, which we'll be putting to two of our science and climate experts. What would you like to know about the changing climate or about how these summits work? Do you think our leaders are responding in the right way? And what would you ask them if you were there? We'd love to hear from you wherever you are in the world, so do please send an email with your question to globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. And if you can, it would be great if you could include a recording of your question along with your name and where you're from. We look forward to hearing from you. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Madeline Drury. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janat Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.